And bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, well, the views of our special guest this evening, who's Cheryl Hancock, and we're going to be with Cheryl in just a minute. Cheryl lives over in Israel. She's an American, and she's been over there for a number of years, of course, talking to the people over there, telling them about her religious faith, and certainly doing a wonderful, wonderful job with both the Palestinians and the Israelis over there, introducing them to our Lord Jesus Christ. But before we get to Cheryl, I wanted to comment. We are living in some of the most difficult and dangerous times in my life, and I've been around for a long time, probably three quarters of a century or more. And simply today we heard that the Canadian dollar was rising and had almost come to parity with the American dollar. Now, it's amazing how you can shape things that you want to conceal. In other words, it's not that the Canadian dollar is rising, it's the American dollar is falling. The American dollar is falling and falling dramatically in relationship to other currencies throughout the world. And this is what we've been trying to tell people for a long period of time. There's a plan to impoverish the American people. It's laid out in the Earth Charter. Get it, read it, understand the spiritual forces that are aligned against America. And I believe God is allowing this to happen. I think we're going to see tremendous, tremendous problems. Certainly the price of gold and silver have broken out dramatically, and if you look and follow what's happening in Dubai, which always gives you a 24 hours advance warning of what's happening throughout the world, why, of course, the price of gold was up almost to $740 an ounce, well over that in Dubai today. So understand that you're seeing the demise of the American dollar, and with that, of course, the destruction of the savings of and the security and the pensions and the insurance policies and the CDs and the bonds of so many Americans who think that there is safety in financial matters, and yet, unfortunately, they don't understand that, I believe, terrible problems face America today, because America, in many respects, has turned their back against God, just as Israel has turned its back against God. And with that as a background, then, let's get to Cheryl. Hi, Cheryl. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Nice talking to you again.
Well, I want you just to go ahead and tell our listeners about yourself, what you're doing. This is an entirely different audience than we talked to the other day, so you just go ahead and pick the story up, what you were doing in Israel, you've been received over there, and what you think is in store for Israel at the present time.
Well, that's a lot, but I've been there since 1999, and I've been working in all different areas of Israel, among the Jewish people, the Bedouins, even the Sudanese who have recently come to Israel, but among the Muslims, collaborators that are helping Israel to expose the suicide attacks on Israel, and they are in hiding from Hamas and Fatah. I go to their villages, I go to their hideouts, I take them humanitarian aid because they're so poor, but I also take them hope, and it's hope in a God of love, and they are reaching up for this God of love, and they want him.
Well, of course, the thing is that most of these people really have no hope. They live in a state of really of despair. They're not accepted by the Palestinians. They're not accepted by the Israelis. And abject poverty, no jobs, separated from their families. But you go ahead with the story, Cheryl.
Yeah. What's going on right now is that these people have permission to be in Israel because they have been collaborators. In other words, they have helped the Israeli authorities save Jewish lives. And they're living in Israel.
Hold that. We'll be right back here. Go right ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, so these people have saved Jewish lives, and they have permission to be in Israel, but their families do not. So most of them are separated from their families. I'm working with between 150 to 200 of them right now, and going house to house, hideout to hideout, and taking them things. They're not allowed to work in Israel, and they're not allowed to drive a car in Israel, only to live in Israel, which is a blessing for them. Israel has been good to them and has allowed them to come in, because if they were in the West Bank, they would be killed. But the only problem is their families are in the West Bank, and they're separated. And when the PA, the Palestinian Authority, whether it be Fatah, Abu Mazen, or Hamas, knows that these people are a collaborator family, the father is a collaborator, then they attack the family, or they do not get assistance from the government, from Hamas or Fatah, and they are left alone, and no one's there to help them. And so some of my friends have died and have had family members die because they have become Christians or because they have been collaborators to Israel.
And when you say died, you mean they were killed?
Of course, they were killed.
Go ahead.
As a matter of fact, there was a 12-year-old boy, because his uncles had become Christians. He was in school. Two boys held him down, and they stabbed him in the heart in front of their teacher, and the teacher did nothing. There was no justice. But this was a Christian family. It didn't matter.
As a Christian, we Christians living here in America, I think, have very little understanding what it's like to be a Christian in one of the Arab countries. Or certainly, in Israel today. So go ahead, Cheryl.
Yeah, and I'm working with many of these people. We've baptized them. As a matter of fact, after we've talked to them and we have given them things, they want to know why we're so nice to them, because they don't see love in their religion. What they learned, they said, is a lot of violence. And to take over the land from the occupiers, and Israeli is who they call the occupiers of their land. And they're taught this from kids growing up. So as we go to them and we talk to them about the love of God and we tell them the other side of the story, they begin learning and they begin to love the Jewish people. Then they want to be baptized. And when they want to be baptized, that means they want to get away from Islam and they want to become a Christian. So that's one of their first steps. Then they have communion, which they're not allowed to do as a Muslim, and they have communion. But what's so interesting, Dr. Stan, is that the people that we have baptized, I went to see them in each of the villages before I left Israel a couple weeks ago to visit them to see how they're doing, and it was the evangelists of that village. Each one that we baptized is taking care of their village. They're showing the Passion film. They're showing the Jesus video in their villages, in these Muslim villages, and their families and their friends and their people in their village are coming to the Lord also.
Well, I think it's really amazing the effect that Lord's Word can have. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Cheryl's just talking about the difference between the Muslim faith and the Christian faith, and how the Muslims that she works with are told that they're really trained from the time they're very young to hate, you know, anybody who's not a Muslim, and how they have to drive the Israelis out of the country, and everything is hatred and violence. And then she comes in as a Christian to help them and extend them love and bring them gifts, and so she's actually baptized many Muslims. And then of course when they return to their villages, they become missionaries on their own, and many of these people in the villages have come to know the Lord. They show the Jesus film. They themselves get baptized, and so there is a growing Christian movement there in the Palestinian part of the Holy Land. That it's so difficult for people to gather here. The Muslims are looking for hope because they're involved in a religion that offers them no hope, nothing but hatred. So go ahead, pick up the story, Cheryl.
Yeah, a lot of them are very, they're oppressed by their leadership. And I'm still talking about either if it's Hamas or if it's Fatah, if it's Abu Mazen. The leadership is not democratic over there. In other words, they don't have a right to speak up and say what they want, because if they do, then they could be killed or a family member could be killed. And as I said before, they do not get food unless they do favors for their leadership. A lot of the money that the West sends, the United States, the EU, we send over there, the money will go to the leadership, but it will not trickle down to the families that are not working with either Fatah or Hamas. And so these people stay very poor, and this is where the Christians come in and try to help and supply needs for these people. Otherwise, they stay poor. It's a very sad situation what's going on, and if they speak up, as I said before, they get killed. And I know people that have been killed, drugged behind cars until they're made example of and died or hung in the square to be made examples of if they say something against their government.
And of course, we're the ones who are financing the government and keeping their government and the government leaders in power, aren't we? Aren't we arming these radicals there in the Palestinian area?
Yeah, what's really funny is we armed Fatah. We sent a whole bunch of money to Fatah, and there was an article before I left Israel that said that millions of dollars went from Fatah over to Hamas.
That's over the video, of course. We're arming both sides in the struggle there, and we're supplying weapons to Fatah, and then it just happens weapons fall into the hands of Hamas. And I mean, we're talking about large numbers of weapons, and you wonder how our leaders could be so inept unintentionally. So
yeah,
we finance both sides, we arm both sides, and then we arm the Israelis as well. It looks like we're really getting ready for a big war over there.
Yeah, there's a war actually going on within Fatah and Hamas. The last I heard from a friend of mine who works inside the territories told me that he went to a hospital to help the people. He's a believer also. And Hamas took Fatah members out of Gaza, you know, outside into the street. They laid them down and they shot their legs, about 10 guys in their 20s. So these guys were sent to Ramallah, and this is just a few weeks ago. And when they were in the hospital in Ramallah, my friend showed up to go and minister to the people, but didn't realize that some of their legs were shot off, some of them just could never walk again, and their family members came in and just outraged. And this is what's going on. Hamas is trying to take over. Yes, they have taken over Gaza already, but they also have people in the refugee camps in Bethlehem, in Jericho, in Ramallah, in all these places, and it's festering. And so there's a fight between Fatah and Hamas, who is going to get the control there.
Well, actually, they had an election, and Hamas won because Fatah was so corrupt. But then we refused to accept the democratic election. We're so in favor of democracy, unless people we don't like win. Of course, people have forgotten that it was the CIA that created this radical Hamas many years ago, and the story goes on and on and on. If you'd like to document that, that's covered in a book we carry called The Devil's Game, where the CIA over there actually financing both sides within the radical Islamic movement. So anyway, of course, what about the Jewish people? Are they open, or at least some of them open, to the Christian message?
The Jewish people now are more open than ever before, and especially since the war last year with Hezbollah. Many of them have listened, taken books, and talked to people about the Lord. Many churches, just like when 9/11 happened over here, people were coming into the churches. Well, now the Jewish people are searching to find out if there is something else. And the areas that I work in, I live among the Jewish people, and these are my neighbors and actually have become my family. And I call it my home on the Moshav. And I live with ultra-Orthodox Jewish people who normally don't accept Christians as friends, but they accept me, and I tell them the truth of who I am and how the Lord works in my life, and they tell me about the Lord in their life and what they do. And it's a mutual relationship, but what I'm finding is that their hearts are softening. They want to know who God really is, not just do all the laws all the time and think that they're going to be okay. They really are searching for the real God. And we know in the Bible that it says, if you search for him with all of your heart, you will find him.
And so, of course, you're not supposed to be actually in any way proselytizing over there. You're actually there really as sort of as a media consultant, or certainly collecting information. But certainly when you're there, you just go ahead and you do talk about the Lord and reach out to the people. Now, well, let's talk a little bit about the preparations for war, because this is really one of the most incredible stories. Certainly, there is a very real possibility of a war against Israel in the next few months. And certainly, this could well be a chemical and biological war. And one of the things you'd want would be a gas mask. And could you explain to our listeners out there how the Israeli government has actually sent soldiers out to collect the gas masks from the Israeli citizens, and then refuses to give them back, despite the fact that the military advisors want it done, but Barak, the defense secretary, refuses to allow the Israeli people to defend themselves against chemical and biological attack? How do you explain that?
Yeah, this is what's going on. They wanted to collect all the gas masks of the people and see that they would renew them, because the last time I got a gas mask, we got gas masks, was when Iraq threatened to bomb Israel with biological warfare. Well, they need to be updated. So everyone turned in their gas masks, and then Barack said he doesn't want to give gas masks out to the people because it might offend the Syrians, and they might think we're going to have war. So it's better that the people don't have the gas masks so that we look peaceful.
No, but that doesn't make any sense, because everybody knows there's going to be a war between Israel and Syria.
That's very true. Everybody's expecting a war. As a matter of fact, they're building up the bomb shelters, the Air Force is building up, the Army's building up, and we know that Syria is prepared for war. So Israel needs to be prepared in all ways, even with the gas masks.
Well, but then why would Barack, the defense minister, refuse to allow the Israeli people to have something that might save their lives and the lives of their families? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And he did give the explanation that he didn't want to offend Syria and cause a war, but what is really behind it, we don't know.
But of course, Israel actually bombed Syria sometime within the last 10 days. In fact, this has been denied by the Israeli government, except Netanyahu came out and admitted it had happened, and now everybody's criticizing Netanyahu, who's been briefed about what was happening, and of course saying that what a traitorous thing to do to admit that we'd bombed Syria, and yet everybody knows they have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that came out in the news just recently. Most people don't even know that. And Netanyahu is trying to tell the people what's going on. Netanyahu has a heart for the people of Israel. And most people want to vote for him and want Olmert out of the office and want Netanyahu in, because Netanyahu is not ready to give up the Golan Heights. He's not ready to give up more land to where Israel will actually be so vulnerable that they won't be able to make it during the next war.
And, of course, basically, Olmert is intent upon giving up everything. He played a part in giving up Gaza, although wasn't that really Sharon who betrayed the people in Gaza? Was that Olmert?
Pardon?
Who was it who was in charge when they pulled the settlers out of Gaza?
Yeah, I believe that was Sharon.
Okay, fine. And so Sharon, of course, betrayed the people, and then he had a stroke after having some tea with them, I believe, with Perez, and then of course Olmert becomes the premier, and he's intent upon turning Judea and Samaria over to the Palestinians. In fact, he wants to pull all the settlers off the West Bank. And really, of course, this will leave Israel with hardly any land at all. In fact, there's even talk about Israel turning Jerusalem over to the Palestinians and giving them complete control of Jerusalem and pulling Israel back to the 1949 boundaries. How do the people of Israel feel about turning Jerusalem over to the Palestinians and pulling back to the 1949 boundaries?
No, this is the heart issue, Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, what's going on? I get very into archaeology, and there's a lot of archaeologists working right now. They have found David's palace, and they have found the rubble from the Temple Mount that the Muslims threw over into the Kidron Valley, and they're sifting through it. And as you sift through this stuff, this dirt, you find pieces of evidence that the Jews did have claim to the Temple Mount. They were there. This history is true. This Bible is true. And as a matter of fact, I found a Babylonian arrowhead when I was working with the archaeologists, which proves that the Babylonians came and they took the Jews into captivity. Now, also what was found recently, now you've heard about the Muslims who demonstrated because they were trying to build a ramp. The Jewish people were trying to build a ramp to get up to the wall, to the Temple Mount. And what was really behind that was the steps of the Pool of Siloam were found that would lead the people from the Pool of Siloam, from the mikvot, which is the cleansing baths, up to the Temple Mount. So there's a fight in archaeology right now. We have to prove that the Jewish people do have claim to the Temple Mount and do have claim to Jerusalem, and the Palestinians are saying not, and this is where the big fight is coming in.
But apparently President Bush has said that he's quite willing to go along with turning Jerusalem over to the Palestinians. Would the Jewish people accept this?
I don't think the Jewish people are going to accept this. There's a big fight already about it.
Why would the American president, a Christian president, want to, simply force the Jews to give up Jerusalem? We'll be right back. With a lot of unanswered questions about what's going on, Cheryl, what are some of the other issues, the main issues there, as far as the Israeli people are concerned? I know when we talked last, you were saying that
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
No logical reason of going over there, because everybody knows there's going to be a war, and it's hard to get housing, it's hard to get a job, you have to learn a new language, Hebrew, and yet Jews are flying in on a regular basis, literally thousands of them. So you pick the story up from there. We were just talking about, of course, the tragedy of what had happened in Gaza, where at least 10,000 Jews, many of them had lived in Gaza for 20 or 30 years, prosperous, beautiful homes, you know, very prosperous farms, employing the Palestinians. And the leaders of Israel betrayed those settlers and forced them at gunpoint and bayonet point to leave their homes, and now they're living as simply as refugees in Israel. And, of course, by turning Gaza over to the Palestinians, it now serves as a launching point for rockets that are raining down on Israel, which doesn't make sense. And, you know, when, of course, Cheryl tries to talk to Israelis, the people she comes into, they say, oh, it's all right, we're going to give land for peace, we're going to have peace, and I don't think there's ever going to be true peace over there in the Holy Land, you know, until you change the hearts of the people, because, you know, you can give all the land you want to, but there are many of the Arabs who will never rest until the Jews have been driven out of the land. Don't you believe that to be true?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, right now, as I'm going around speaking in America, I'm showing a film that a journalist friend of mine did. He went into the prisons in Israel, and he interviewed the people that were suicide bombers that got caught, or suicide bombers that were a partner to someone that did blow up, like the Sbarro pizza place. And as they interview these people, they say, why did you do this? Do you feel sorry that you did it? And they said, oh, absolutely not. I wish we could put all the Jews in one room and blow them all up. And these are the people that they're letting out of prison. These are the people that they're negotiating with the Palestinians to let out of prison, and they're going to be doing it again. Now, the last word that I heard on the movie that I'm showing is that there will never be peace with Israel because they are occupying our territory, and we need to get rid of them. This is their mindset. These are my neighbors. These are the people that we live around.
And I think what people have to understand is the Israeli government is releasing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these Palestinian terrorists, and they're getting nothing in return for it. I mean, they released 250, three or 400. They got back a couple of bodies of dead Israeli soldiers. Talking about releasing hundreds more, and you have to ask yourself, why would the Israelis be releasing Palestinian terrorists? We're going to go back to being terrorists dedicated to one thing, and that is killing Jews. Doesn't make sense unless there's another agenda behind what's going on.
Yeah, and you know, it's not over only over in Israel either, and this is an Islamic concept, and they said they are behind Osama bin Laden. They are behind the Islamic movement, and they want the world to become Islamic and under Islamic law. And this is what the people are talking about that are there. And they're not only talking about, like I said, Israel, but they're talking about England, they're talking about America, they're talking about France, and they're talking about Germany and wherever they can. So they're just beginning with Israel.
And, of course, you actually have this film that you're actually showing all across the country as you're going from city to city giving talks?
That's right, yeah.
Well, when we get back here, of course, we'll want to have our listeners learn how they can get in touch with you and how, if you're coming to their area, they would be able to hear you talk and then hopefully if they would like to help Cheryl and what she's doing, they can get in touch with your ministry here in the United States. How long will you be here?
I'll be here. My last speaking engagement is December 9th. I'll be speaking from San Diego to Seattle. And so I'll be passing through the Central Coast quite a bit. Next year I will do the Midwest, and then I'll do the East Coast.
In other words, you're going to keep coming back every year and just cover the whole country.
Lord willing, but there's a message that needs to get out to the American people, and that is that we need to wake up and see what's going on around us, not only what's going on in America, because it's coming here.
I'm sure that it really is, and I think the American people are just totally oblivious to most of what's going on in the world. We live in a very, very violent world. And, of course, behind this whole radical Islamic movement are powerful spiritual forces. And unfortunately, many people don't understand what caused this resurgence of radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. And, of course, you really only have to, of course, begin looking into your tax money. In many instances, your tax money funded this resurgence, this radical form. I mean, why are we funding Hamas and Fatah in Palestine? Why, of course, are we funding the Pakistani government that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys in Afghanistan? Why are we funding the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? Doesn't make sense, does it? Or maybe it really does. Dr. Stan, our guest is Cheryl Hancock, and And so, basically, Sydney, do you have a job over there? Or are you able to spend full time in what you're doing?
Well, what I do over there is I have a radio program that comes out weekly, and I interview people all over Israel. So I go into many different areas, the West Bank. I go into, like I said, ultra-Orthodox Jews. I ran into some Sudanese who were running from the Muslims in Sudan and made it over the border. Very interesting stories. But what I'm able to do is just to go out and bring the truth from over there to here that you don't hear, you know, on the regular news. But I'm supported just by people who are interested in listening. I went over there as a missionary. I went over there to help people. I went over there to do humanitarian aid, and I became a correspondent while I was there. But I will continue helping the people as much as possible because these people need help. All kinds of people there need help.
Well, now, this radio program you do, is this on an Israeli radio station? Is it an internet program? What sort of outreach does it have?
No, what I send radio programs, I send the interviews from Israel to Bible Voice Broadcasting, BibleVoiceBroadcasting.org, which is in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and they pick up the radio programs each week, and then people pick those up and re-air them.
I know. Okay, fine. And then are they broadcast on shortwave? How do they get into Israel?
No, the radio programs do not go into Israel. This is to bring information from Israel out to the West.
I see.
People out to in the West. All just right. Like you're doing, Dr. Stan.
Okay, well, how often do you do the program?
Every week. I have a weekly program.
All right, fine. Well, I'll tell you, radio is a wonderful, wonderful way to reach people. Do you get much of a response from people who listen to the programs?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do, because what they're doing is they're listening to people that are everyday people. I don't go for the VIPs. I don't go for the regular news. I go to the villages, and I interview the people to find out how they're living and what they're going through. And so you hear a whole different story about what's going on in Israel.
Well, what about food? Is food readily available, and especially, to the Palestinian, the Palestinians who are living in Israel that, certainly aren't allowed to get jobs. How do they manage to live?
They don't manage to live very well at all. As a matter of fact, the people, the Palestinians that are in Israel, they're Arab, of course, and there are Arab Israelis that do not trust them because they feel like they're traitors. That's why they're Palestinians living in Israel. So the Arabs have nothing to do with them. The Jewish people are afraid of them because most Palestinians, are acquainted to suicide bombers, so they stay away from them. So no one's helping these people.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just Cheryl was just talking about the plight of the Palestinians, those who have helped Israel, and yet, of course, although they're allowed to stay in Israel, why, of course, the Jews don't trust them because they're Arabs. The Arabs who are living in Israel as the citizens, they are very, very resentful of the situation, and they certainly wouldn't help the Palestinians who helped Israel. And so, really, nobody is there to help them, pretty much, except Cheryl, and apparently they get jobs, but they can't get a good-paying job because they're not supposed to be working. So these people are really reduced to ultimate poverty, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And the sad part is that these people have permission to be in Israel. Their permission is going to be up either this year or next year. One group is this year and one group is next year. There are 10,000 of them that live in Israel. And these are the people that I'm going to, and I'm trying to bring hope to. I'm trying to bring food to, clothing, even help their kids. The kids don't have school books to go to school. They don't have their backpacks. And when they don't have these things, they are made examples of. And they're saying, this is what happens if you're a collaborator family. You don't get anything. You'll end up just like them. So that they're making less collaborators, less people that help Israel.
Well, now, is there any way that they could come to America or go to Great Britain or go to some other country, or most countries closed to them?
Well, we try to get some of them out, and we have been successful in some cases. In some cases, we're still working on because they are separated from their families. One of my best friends, who is my translator, a great believer, was a Muslim. He's separated from his 8 children and his wife, and now since 2002. And so we're trying to get him out so that he can be together with his family.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, before we go on, I would like you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your ministry. And you do have an email over here. Do you have a website?
Yes, there is a website, and that has my itinerary also where I'm going to be speaking. And the website is www.fastforlife.org.
That's fast for life, like a fast?
Yeah, like fasting for life. It came from Isaiah 57. What fast did God choose for us to do? And that's to help the poor and et cetera.
All right, so it's www.fastforlife.com and then
.org.
.org, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they can reach you that way. And, of course, at least learn about your itinerary, and you'll be speaking on the West Coast then between now and December, huh?
That's right, yes.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, if you have a question for Cheryl, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Do you think that there's going to be a war between Israel and Syria, or Israel and Iran, or Israel and Lebanon, or Egypt, or any of the other Arab countries in the near future?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, what I'm thinking right now, the president of Iran is coming to the United States on Tuesday to speak at the UN, and he's already said that Bush needs to become a Muslim. And he also said that Israel needs to be wiped out. Why he's speaking at the UN, why they're allowing him to come and do this, I don't know. But Iran has threatened Israel. And so we know that as they build up their nuclear power, that Israel is the first target. Of course, Syria is saying, if you don't give us the Golan Heights, we're going to be on your tail. You know, so Syria also is going against Israel. And that's why there's negotiations between Olmert and Syria right now. Also, Syria is letting weapons go through to Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon. And they have more weapons now than they did last year. So they're beefing up. And then we have Hamas over in the Gaza area who say they need to take over Israel and take over the occupiers out of their land.
Well, do most of the people in Israel believe that the war is coming?
Yeah, most people know that the war is coming. It's not just that they believe. They know the war is coming, and they are getting their bomb shelters ready. They are preparing. And that's what's so interesting about them all coming back. Why are they all coming back? I mean, this also is written in the Bible, as we know it's in prophecy, that all nations will gather around Jerusalem. And that's when the Lord will come back, and he'll intervene. But still, the war is building up. It's climaxing. And as we are watching what's going on, we see that it's getting closer and closer.
And I think that really the American people, you know, they cannot believe the whole of the Middle East is going to go up in a sheet of flame, I fear, very, very soon. And it will not simply be the Israelis who will be involved, but American and American boys will be involved. And our ships, they will be sitting ducks there. We have three aircraft carrier task forces sitting in the Persian Gulf today, plus one Marine Expeditionary Force. And, of course, although the Iranians may not have a sophisticated military, they've got a lot of very, very small boats, very fast boats, all armed with, of course, the military equipment that they've gotten from the Russians, largely built with American technology and largely financed by America indirectly, which is to this very day, while America is having to borrow $2 to $3 billion every day while we're still helping to fund Russia. And you have to ask yourself why. And those of you who haven't read my little pamphlets, it's called the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance should read that to understand how we have built up Russia, how we've built up their technology. They then are providing the weapons for Iran and Syria that will be used against Israel and against American forces. And none of this makes any logical sense. So if it doesn't make any logical sense, there must be another explanation. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Cheryl, you were saying that the people are trying to get their bunkers, the civilian defense bunkers and underground shelters in shape. Is the government helping them to do it? Are they doing this on their own?
Yeah, no, the government is trying to help as much as possible. There's a lot of arguing going back and forth because Sderot, which is getting hit all the time from Gaza, has not had enough help. And the kids that were going to the kindergarten there, have had to go to different schools because their school keeps getting hit. And so it's a problem. It's a problem getting the money and getting the government going. And as you're talking about getting bomb shelters and getting prepared for what's going on, as I'm over in Israel and I'm listening to the Palestinians, I'm in these villages, I'm hearing that not only Israel is under attack or going to be under attack, but America is going to be under attack. And I'm wondering how many people in America are ready for something like this to happen.
I think very, very few of them are. In fact, it was very interesting today. You know, when we talked before about how the government in Israel has taken the gas masks away from the Israeli people and won't give them back again, despite the fact that all the military advisors say, why not give the gas mask to the Israeli people so they can defend themselves? And I was up on the internet today looking for gas masks, and just for curiosity's sake, and there was a website there commenting on the various gas masks that are available in America and discouraging people from buying any of them. In fact, just saying how terrible they all are. And of course, many of these are standard Russian gas masks or Israeli gas masks or French gas masks or Belgian gas masks. And they had a reason why no American should have any gas masks. And I'm reading this website and I'm saying to myself, why would anybody put up a website to try to discourage Americans from being protected against the possibility of a chemical or biological attack? That doesn't make any sense. It makes about as much sense as taking the gas masks away from the Israeli people and then refusing to give them back. So somebody obviously has an agenda, not only in Israel, they have an agenda right in America. And so what do the Palestinians tell you about the coming war on America?
Well, the Palestinians are telling me that America is the target because Americans are Zion. Now, Zionist is going to be a big word. If you're a Zionist, that means you are siding with Israel. You can call yourself a Christian, and it's not so bad, but if you're a Zionist, that means you are an enemy to Islam. And a lot of the evangelical Christians are Zionists. And these are people that are going to be targeted.
So how are they going to target them? I mean, they're over there, and we're over here, and we got these big oceans between us.
Oh, boy. What about 9/11? How did they get us then? No, there are ways that they have planned. There are people over here already. There are some Hamas members over here. There are mosques over here talking against Americans and telling people that they need to go and they need to take care of the infidels. They either need to bow the knee to Allah or they need to be cut off. And this is happening in mosques here in America and in England. And I have videotape that somebody went in, snuck into the mosque for 3 months, and took videotape of the imam speaking and telling the people that they need to take care of the people in their country. These are Western countries.
And, of course, this is going on right in America today, and our government certainly knows it, and they're doing absolutely nothing about it. You have to ask yourself why. We have actually a great DVD. It's called, I guess it's a video, it's called Jihad in America. A lot of these films were shot back in 1988 and 1999 when the founders of Al-Qaeda were speaking in a place called Oklahoma City and talking about, of course, bringing the bloodbath to America. And these films were shot by the FBI and never shown to the American people. When they tried to show them in 93, they were actively suppressed. Somebody gave orders that this video was not to be shown. It's Jihad in America. We have it, and it sounds like what very, very similar to what you have. Is your video going to be available after you leave? Are you offering this to your ministry?
Yes, I'm taking it everywhere I go, and I'm handing them out at the places I'm speaking at. And a friend of mine is making, we shortened the version, it's 39 minutes, but we shortened it to 8 minutes. And it's very, very good in telling you how the people really feel and what's really going to be happening in the future, what they think. And, you know, these people, as I'm talking to you and as I talk to the people in the churches, these people have been brainwashed so bad. And when you listen to them and you listen to what they believe, it's incredible what their intentions are. So to get the truth out to the people is very important. So my point when I'm out sharing is to care about what's going on around you and know what's going on around in the world and to share with people about the Lord, because that's important, because these people probably have never heard about the Lord, about a God of love, and to prepare for what's coming, because we as believers, as Christians, need to be ready for when this world starts shaking, and we can help other people during that time.
But of course, these are Palestinians that you're dealing, that your friend is dealing with, is talking to them, and they're telling him that America is going to be attacked from within. Then,
yes, this is video talking about how they want to attack Americans and wipe out the Jews. Yes,
right. People have to understand we live in a very, very unsafe world today. But what we're really talking about is within a matter of a few weeks or even a few months, why we could be at war with the Islamic world. Everything is in place for an attack on Iran. We're simply looking for justification for the attack. President Bush is intent upon taking out both Iran and Syria. He talked about this previously. We have videos certainly of William Crystal, who heads the Project for the New American Century, pointing out that all of these places are targets for America to destroy the existing society. My fear, though, is when we do this, we will inflame the entire Islamic world. And, of course, the solution is to try to win these people around to Christianity. Certainly, I don't think we're going to bring them into a relationship with the Lord by bombing them and killing their women and children. So, you know, certainly, but you've had great success. Are there other people working with the Palestinians as well, Cheryl, to try to get these people away from this philosophy, this religion of hatred?
Yeah, it's amazing what's going on in Israel right now. There is a gal and her son who moved into a refugee camp in Jericho, and they began handing out bags of rice with tracts in it about the Lord. Well, people were taking these bags of rice because they needed the food. They got in trouble because of the tracts, but then the government okayed it. The Palestinian Authority okayed it. Now there's over 300 people in Jericho that are worshiping the Lord. And now she's taking these people that are in Jericho that have become believers into the refugee camps in Bethlehem and into Hebron. This is a movement that's going on in Israel. These Palestinians want to know a God of love. They are tired of following a God of hatred and violence and teaching their kids this way, and sending their kids to be suicide bombers. They want a different life, and they're finding it.
And, of course, there is no hope at all within the Muslim faith. This is the great tragedy. And the average American doesn't understand that. Doesn't understand that we are keeping, of course, the Saudi monarchy in power, and they're the ones who are financing this religion of hatred throughout the world, throughout Africa, throughout the Near East, the Middle East, and right here in America. I mean, who's building all these beautiful mosques all over America? Well, the Saudis are, with the money that we're giving them, and it doesn't make sense. Why would we allow the radical imams to be going into our prisons and recruiting terrorists there in American prisons, giving them special food, special days off, special, you know, all sorts of very, very special things? If you're a Muslim and want a prison, you get a lot better treatment and food than the regular Christian prisoners do. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Well, a lot of unanswered questions out there, and all we can do is try to get people to realize that nothing is as it appears to be. So, Cindy, what about Smiley? Does Smiley work closely with you?
Yes, he's my translator, and we go to many places together, and he has been ordained by his Messianic church. Smiley is a Muslim background, but he goes to a Jewish background church. And this is where we can see peace happening. It's when the Prince of Peace lives in the heart, when the people can come together. And so we work together very closely, but he is in a horrible predicament because he is separated from his family also. And he needs to be together with them. And as a matter of fact, Fatah approached his son, who is in his teens now, late teens, and said, if you want to make some money for your family since your father is no longer with you, then why don't you help us? And see, what they do is they try to recruit these young kids into their organization and have them become warriors for them. And so my friend Smiley was able to stop that from happening. But it's very important that this family gets out from under the grips of the West Bank. All these kids have to go to Muslim schools and indoctrinated with the occupiers taking over their land, and they need to kill them.
And, of course, what do you hope then, to be able to bring the family into Israel? What are your hopes?
The real hope is to get them out of the country completely.
In other words, they get them into some other country that would accept them, and then they could certainly be missionaries, or at least, you know, when you've got eight children, why, it's pretty hard to support them.
Yeah, but the problem is, if they are in Israel, there are still people from Hamas and Fatah that come out, and they attack my friends, and they kill them. I've had two guys that I went to their hideout, and I went up there, and we prayed with them, and we talked to them, and they wept, and we brought them things. And the next thing I knew, that somebody went up there with sticks and chains, beat them, and put them in the hospital, and they're gone. So they're not safe in Israel either.
And I think that the trouble is that people here in America have little idea of the suffering and certainly the danger that people are in when they become Christians in that part of the world. And I wonder how many of our Christians living here would be willing to risk their lives and their families' lives simply to attest to the fact that they are followers of the risen Lord. It's very easy to be a Christian here, but how many people are willing to become martyrs for their faith? Well, it's going on. It's going on all throughout the world today, and it's time that Americans begin to understand what it really means to be a true Christian. Well, Cheryl, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I just want to say that to the people that I work with were asked to go back to Islam by Fatah, by Hamas, and they said, if you go back to Islam and you do this on television, if you make it known that this is a bunch of nonsense, this Jesus is a bunch of nonsense, we won't bother you, we won't kill you. And you know what? These people did not go back. As a matter of fact, they didn't love their lives unto death. Remember in Revelation it said they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they love not their lives unto death. These people are living for Christ under all this persecution. And I think one of these days we're going to have to do the same thing, and we better make the decision now that we're going to be standing in that time.
Amen to that. Well, I think that, because one of the things we do, Cheryl, is to try to get people to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. And, I mean, you can have Christianity on the cheap over here and go to church every Sunday and then, of course, live the way you want for the rest of the week, or you could simply dedicate your life to our Lord, and whether it's whatever the ministry be, we have to be ministers of the Lord 24 hours a day. Of course, you're laying your life on the line over there, and so far the Lord's been merciful to keep you safe, but when you go into the Palestinian area, it is always a dangerous thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I've been attacked a few times. So I've had hand grenade in my backyard, pipe bomb. I've had a rock thrown at me. They tried to kill me getting it through my windshield. But so far I'm still going, and I believe that's all due to prayer. So I thank everyone for their prayers.
And so we do ask you to pray for Cheryl and certainly for the other missionaries over there, because there are missionaries, and they're working in Israel, and they're really working all throughout the Muslim world, trying to spread the word of the Lord, because this is the only way we're ever going to change people's hearts. We're not going to change their hearts by bombing them. We're not going to change their hearts by starving them. We're not going to change their hearts, as we have in certainly in Iraq, by turning off their electricity and their water and their sewage and take away their jobs. And it is the love of the Lord that will bring people into a personal relationship with them. And isn't it a shame that America is not practicing that as a nation? But we as individuals, we don't have to listen to our leaders. What our job is, of course, to each individually, of course, manifest through our own actions the love of our Lord. One more thought before I let you go, and then I'm going to have to let you go, Cheryl.
Okay, well, the last thought is to remember to care about what's going on around you, to share with whoever you can, and to prepare for what's coming.
Amen to that. Beautifully said, Cheryl. God bless you. Thank you so much, and we'll hope to have you at least on. I think there's one program we haven't had you on. That's the morning program. We'll get you there.
Okay. Thank you.
Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope that you have enjoyed our program with Cheryl, and we're not using her last name. But certainly we know it, and we are in constant contact with her. And you get her if you go onto her website, or you want to get in touch with her email by email. We'll be glad to help you. And we, my wife and myself, do help to finance her ministry, because we think she's doing a wonderful job. She's never asked for any support, but God's people have provided it for her. She risks her life literally every day. She's in the Holy Land, you know, but can we do at least do the best we can to help? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are living in the most dangerous times of my life. Certainly we know that the Israelis attacked Syria within this last week to 10 days. There have been a number of Syrian and Iranian officers were killed within the last week. They were actually putting chemical warheads onto missiles. We know, of course, that the Christian leader, one of the Christian leaders in Lebanon, along with seven other people, were killed this last week. Iran has said that, you know, if war comes, that they will certainly attack Israel and the American installations over in the Middle East. And of course, dozens of people died this last week in the various rocket attacks on Israel. It's only a matter of time before war breaks out over there, and we ask you simply to try to understand the background of so much of what's going on, because none of it makes sense. If you've never read the book See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent, he will tell you that when he was living in Iraq, he never met an Iraqi who did not believe the American government, the American State Department, was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. The book The Devil's Game is a very important book. I mean, who financed and created Hamas? The United States government, in conjunction with the Israeli Secret Service. Why would they create Hamas? It's a radical Islamic movement. Well, for exactly the same reason that they financed the Muslim Brotherhood and have for years, this radical form of Islam. And we've created the best enemy. Money could buy. Where did Al-Qaeda come from? Where is the Taliban getting its funding today? Getting its funding from the Pakistani government. And who's funding the Pakistani government? Your tax dollars. How do you make any sense out of this? Well, it's very, very simple. There are spiritual forces working behind the scenes intent upon plunging the world into a massive world war that is going to destroy the financial and military stability of our nation. And this war is coming, in my estimation, very soon. We suggest you get my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, and the syllabus that goes along with it, and we'll explain to you exactly how we got into Iraq and who manipulates things behind the scene. And believe me, the president is simply carrying out the orders that come from a group known as the Project for the New American Century. And you can go to their website, newamericancentury.org. You can get our syllabus and get the important things that are up on the website, and you'll then be able to better evaluate what you're going to be reading. And this is not imaginary. It's real. That's their website, not mine, newamericancentury.org. Of the talk, Iraq, the Untold Story, the syllabus by the same name. You'll want to get our pamphlets on Foreknowledge 9/11, what really led up to that tragic day. The video 9/11, the day that changed America forever, and I think you better get it in video form. They're having trouble with the DVDs, but it is available in video. And very, very revealing. And then, of course, we hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, 5 days a week, trying to educate people about the spiritual battle that's going on. Please remember, we're putting on an all-day seminar here on October the 28th. We're bringing in speakers from across the country, and we think you'll find them fascinating. That's October 28th here in the Aptos Seascape Golf Course on the north shore of Monterey Bay. And call us at 1-800-544-8927. If you can make it, we'll be serving lunch. Should be a great time. We'll be right back. Thank you. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I do remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of William Greig, who is formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine. He's now, of course, he's doing radio. He has his own blog site. He's written a number of books. In fact, how's that latest book doing, William? Is it about ready to go to press?
Yeah, I was just talking today with the illustrator who's doing the cover art, and he's just finishing up the final touches on it, and hopefully within the next week, week and a half or so, we'll have finished books that we can provide to your listeners if they're interested.
All right, now what is the title, and what's this book on?
The title is Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State.
And, of course, what you're really talking about is all the legislation that is being passed here to take away our freedom so that we can protect ourselves against Osama bin Laden, who wants to take away our freedom?
Yes. In the first chapter of the book, I talk about the fact that statistically, your typical American is likelier to die from an allergic reaction to peanuts than he is to die in a terrorist attack of any kind. And historically, looking back over the last quarter century or so, more Americans have died at the hand of police officers and other law enforcement agents that have been killed by terrorists. And so what we're seeing now is that the larger menace, which is unaccountable, militarized, federalized law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies, is being amplified in terms of its powers in order to protect us from the lesser menace, which would be foreign terrorists of the ilk that Osama bin Laden represents, many of whom were subcontractors for the same government that is now protecting us from them. But the most important thing people need to recognize here is that in the context of what is being called the Homeland Security System, we're seeing the rapid, it's not gradual anymore, the rapid emergence of a full-blown garrison state. That's something that our founding fathers had warned against. They weren't acquainted with modern totalitarianism, but they were acquainted with unaccountable power when it was wielded by a king or another ruler, and they were very concerned about standing armies, about the possibility that those establishments to which we have resort to protect us from external enemies would become the biggest menace to our civil rights, as Alexander Hamilton put it in the Federalist Paper number 8. And so we're seeing right now something that has never happened before in our history. We've had occasion during the war between the states, for instance, and during the late 1790s, the era of the Alien Sedition Acts, we've had instances where some elements of our government have gone more or less insane, and critical liberties indispensable to the functioning of a free society and deeply embedded in the Anglo-Saxon tradition have been set aside, suppressed, or attenuated. And of course, in the early years of the century, World War One, the immediate aftermath of World War One, the so-called Red Scare, there were similar concerns about the infiltration of foreign anarchists and terrorists who would be doing all kinds of terrible things. One of them actually bombed the mailbox of the Attorney General of the United States at one point. But the point is, for the first time, we see the whole public, more or less, either passively accepting this or, in some circles, enthusiastically supporting it, and it's got the support, this development of this Homeland Security State, of the leadership of both branches of the establishment party, Republican and Democrat alike. And we see the President of the United States claiming the power to act as an elected dictator in a way that's quite frankly without precedent in recent history. So I think that we've reached the most critical and dangerous juncture in the history of our country in terms of that which defines us, which is liberty under law.
And of course, our founding fathers feared exactly the thing would happen. It is happening today. They recognize when all power is taken into Washington, D.C., we would have a government there as venal and authoritative as the one we'd separated from in 1776.
Actually, we were much worse off than we were, than our ancestors were, rather, during the late colonial period when the Patriots decided to withdraw their consent from the British government to delegitimize the king and his ministry and to create an independent collection of states, a commonwealth of independent states, not like the commonwealth of independent states so-called in the former Soviet Union, but rather free and independent states who united for the purpose of withdrawing from the British Empire. When our patriot forebears did this, they were actually much better off. One example I cite in the book is that of the Boston Massacre. Captain, I believe, Preston, I think that was the name of the commanding officer of the Lobsterbacks there, who opened fire on what was, by any reasonable reckoning, a mob of people, an angry mob, who were throwing rocks covered with snow. They were actually throwing rocks, not just snowballs, they were throwing rocks at the British soldiers trying to provoke them. And several of the protesters were gunned down. The men who did this, the British soldiers who did this, stood trial in Boston. Some of them were acquitted, some of them were convicted, but the really important thing to recognize here is that these men stood trial. This was in 1770. It was, of course, after the tensions had flared up between the mother country and the rest of the colonies over a number of things having to do with tax policy and other issues of individual freedom and commerce. And the men who were under the command of Captain Preston were defended by John Adams. And he did this because he insisted that they had the right to a fair trial under the precepts and canons of common law as practiced throughout the British realm at the time. But the important thing to me is that these men stood trial. And this was something which emerged out of a riot. It wasn't simply a matter of these British soldiers opening fire on people who were simply minding their own business. They were opening fire on a rowdy mob. Of course, it was an excessive use of force. It was homicide. It was manslaughter. But they stood trial. Now, fast forward to late 20th, early 21st century America, under the United States, or under the United State, if you will. Take a look at what happened at Ruby Ridge in 1992. You had a very small, young teenage boy by the name of Samuel Weaver, who was murdered. He was shot in the back after having his arm blown off by a sniper with the FBI, with the U.S. Marshal Service, rather. He was running away from the engagement into his home when he was gunned down. The following day, his mother, Vicki Weaver, had her head blown off by an FBI sniper by the name of Lon Horiuchi. She had her head blown off while she was holding a nursing child. Lon Horiuchi, a few years ago, was supposed to go on trial here in Idaho. I'm speaking to you from Payette, Idaho, which is a small town.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William Gregg, of course, is talking about really how, certainly during the Revolutionary War, the period leading up to the Revolutionary War, when, of course, some of the redcoats, the British soldiers, fired at an unruly crowd that were throwing stones at them, and several of the people were killed. But at least these people went on trial, and John Adams actually defended the British soldiers. Some of them were convicted of manslaughter, others were not, but comparing at least under the British rule and with the fairness of concepts of British law under God and common law, and then comparing that with what happened here in America at the time of Ruby Ridge, when, of course, first of all, the son was actually shot in the back while running away from some marshals, and then the following day a FBI sniper blew his mother's head off when she was standing silhouetted in the doorway holding a nursing child, and Lon Horiuchi was to go on trial in Idaho. And what happened in that trial?
Well, what happened is that under pressure from federal authorities, the heroes who run the legal system here in the state of Idaho did not prosecute him under the homicide laws, the laws for negligent homicide here in the state of Idaho. Under our Constitution, of course, homicide, murder, all these types of crimes against persons and property are within the exclusive jurisdiction of the states, unless you end up with interstate crime, in which case there is a federal role, but the federal role is supposed to be subordinate. The states are supposed to prosecute crimes against persons and property. But the state of Idaho did not prosecute Lon Horiuchi. He was liable, of course, for prosecution, I believe in Boundary County, Idaho, for the deaths of Sammy and Vicki Weaver, and he didn't stand trial because the state of Idaho, like every other state in the Union, is now simply an administrative unit of the central government. The states originally created the general government, the so-called federal government. It was supposed to be an agent of the states, and now the creature has surpassed the creator, and it now directs things.
In other words, if you're a federal official, you can kill anybody you want to, and
exactly.
You don't have to worry about it. But, of course, everybody, Lon Horiocchi wasn't responsible for the death of Sammy. That was done by the marshals.
Yeah, forgive me. That was an error on my part, yes.
That's
we don't know who it was who fired the kill shot that ended the life of Sammy Weaver. It might have been William Deegan, who was the marshal who was killed. But in any case, yes, I misspoke. It was Vicki Weaver for whom Lon Horiocchi should have stood trial, whose death Lon Horiocchi should have stood trial for.
You know, we have the most wonderful interview with a man named David Niven, who was actually the defense attorney for the Weavers, at least as far as that was concerned. And he simply pointed out during the trial they had an opportunity of looking at Deegan's knapsack. He was shot in the back. There was a bullet hole through his backpack. He was shot by his own marshals. They were the ones who killed him. And that subject, we have still have that interview, but the media totally blacked out. They wanted you to think that somehow he'd been shot by the little boy that they killed running away. And the truth of the matter, he was actually killed by the marshals, and they concealed the truth from the American people. They could not allow the American people to realize that we have murderers in our own government. They work for our government, and when somebody's running away with their arm blown off, you shoot them in the back.
Yeah.
When they shoot their own man in the back, somebody probably by accident, I don't think they intentionally killed Marshall Deegan, they just shot him in the back, and
yeah,
not a word of that ever got out.
Yeah, criminal negligence through culpable ineptitude, I think, would be the best explanation for Marshall.
I think these guys were scared to death. That they knew that they weren't supposed to be there. They knew they were violating the law. They knew that they'd killed this boy. And, well, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, they probably had a complete loss of composure. Besides that, it's nowhere near as much fun to be a federal law enforcement officer tracking down innocent people when the innocent people shoot back. That sort of ruins the experience for the feds. But in any case, Lon Horiocchi made a claim, and this claim was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is supposedly a liberal circuit court. It's a statist circuit court. I don't care whether it's liberal or conservative. The fact is, it's statist. Way back in June, I believe, of 1999, they upheld a form of immunity for Lon Horiocchi called Supremacy Clause Immunity. And that, of course, is a branch of what is called sovereign immunity, which is one of the most mischievous, if not detestable, concepts in law, which holds, basically, boiled down to its essence, that the federal government can only be sued, or people who work for the federal government can only face criminal or civil liability when they choose to be sued or when they choose to face liability. In this case, because Lon Horiocchi was acting under the color of the supposed authority of the federal government, he could not stand trial for killing Vicki Weaver, in spite of the fact that in open court, before he was taken into protective custody, Lon Horiocchi admitted that in his scope he saw the head of Vicki Weaver before he pulled the trigger and ended her life. Now, there's an interesting contrast, not only with the people who stood trial in 1770, the men under the command of Captain Preston, who were involved in the Boston Massacre. That's a huge contrast. I mean, the government that those men worked for was such a tyrannical, despotic regime that our founding fathers fought a desperate war to free themselves against that central government. And now, by the end of the 20th century, the dawning of the 21st, in America, a federal assassin can get off scot-free, not face any kind of criminal or civil liability as a person, after he consciously pulls the trigger and guns down an unharmed nursing mother.
But of course, he said he was ordered to do that.
Sure.
He was ordered to do that because some psychologists had said that they thought the mother was really sort of influencing the family, and because the mother was influencing the family, if they could kill her, then of course the rest of them would surrender. So they were justified in doing that because the psychiatrist or psychologist who'd analyzed the family felt that they knew what
was
right.
Dominant personality, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was something that I think Alan Bach talked about in his book Ambush at Ruby Ridge, and that's, of course, a chilling thing when you can recognize that the government that rules us is capable of making analyses of that variety and then presumably instructing its agents to end the life of somebody summarily simply in order to obtain a tactical advantage in a hostage standoff here.
But of course, the thing is that actually Horiyoshi was just carrying out orders.
Sure.
How could you criticize him for carrying out orders?
Yeah, it's the old Nuremberg refrain. You can go back to Henry V, where King Henry by this time disguised himself on the eve of battle, and as he was wandering among the ranks of his soldiers, trying to assess their mood on the eve of Agincourt. One of them talked about how he wondered if they were really being ordered to do something that was just by invading France and pressing the claim for the French throne. And one of them said, well, it matters not to us. We know enough if we know that we're the king's servants. And if it's wrong, then our obedience wipes the sin of it out of us. Of course, that's something Shakespeare didn't agree with. He didn't agree with that principle that's now known as the Nuremberg defense. I was only following orders. But that is the standard right now when you're talking about somebody like Alain Horiyoshi, who was there at Ruby Ridge, who's also at Waco a few months later, carrying out the same service on behalf of the government that rules us. One of the interesting things that I think many people don't appreciate, this is something I talk about in my book, is that there was a hitman for the Boston Irish mob by the name of Kevin Weeks, who worked for a fellow by the name of Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger was the head of the Boston mob. He was also an informant for the FBI. He committed several murders while he was working for the FBI, and the FBI covered up those murders.
Oh, he even tortured the people to death.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was awful. I mean, he was a sadistic, perverted person.
And working for the FBI, and they were covering for this torture and murder, and it went right up to J. Edgar Hoover knew exactly what was going on, and they covered for him for 20 years or more.
Yeah, and they sent innocent men to prison to cover up for him, too.
Right.
The thing that I find interesting, Kevin Weeks back in the early 1990s was ordered to carry out a hit on a journalist by the name of Howie Carr, who had been making himself obnoxious to Whitey Bulger by exposing some of the corrupt things that were going on in terms of his relationship with the FBI. And Kevin Weeks, at a particular date, I can't remember exactly what year, he talks about this in his memoir, had Howie Carr's head in the crosshairs of a sniper rifle. He didn't pull the trigger because he didn't want to kill Howie Carr in front of his grade school-aged daughter. Now, the difference between between Kevin Weeks and Lon Horiyoshi is that Lon Horiyoshi could make that shot, you know, and in the difference between those two men, as I've said before, resides the exact definition of the phrase good enough for government work. You have to be more ruthless and more amoral than a mob hitman if you're going to be working for the federal government in some capacity that might involve killing innocent people.
I think that is really is such an amazing, amazing story. And I remember when they interviewed that mafia hitman on 60 Minutes, and apparently he turned state's evidence and told mm-hmm. them all about Lon, and I don't know whether he went to prison or not. He may have just got off scot-free for all the murders. I think he admitted it. I'd have forgotten a dozen murders, something like that.
Yeah.
And they let him off as long as he admitted to it, and wasn't that nice? And now, of course, but the fact that he would not actually kill this man, and Lon Horiyoshi saw nothing wrong with it. They're both immoral individuals. One at mm-hmm. least had a sense of honor, the other did not.
Yeah.
He was the FBI agent.
Yeah, I mean, the really interesting thing about that is that there is a residual sense of proportion that governs at least certain elements of the underworld. You don't get that with people who work for government. In that same memoir, there's talk about how back in the 1970s, I believe it was, one of the people working for Whitey Bulger's mob had suggested firebombing the home of a rival. And Bulger put the kibosh on that, saying, well, no, we can't do that because we'd end up probably killing innocent people because the fire would get out of control. And, of course, at Waco, you had basically that same scenario play out where you had 80 people die because of the disproportionate overkill style attack on a religious community that had provoked the ire of the federal government by shooting back when they were under the unlawful, unnecessary, unwarranted attack of an ATF strike team that was simply trying to get a good headline for that evening's TV news.
Well, I talked to, of course, Sarah Bain, who was the head of the jury. She said the wrong people were on trial.
Yeah.
They never wanted the people of Waco to go to prison. They never felt they were guilty. Go right ahead.
But these are the sort of things that people will see sort of in isolation or as a series of random events. without understanding some of the underlying trends and continuities that connect these things. And what we're talking about here, first of all, would be the militarization of law enforcement, which means that we're abandoning entirely the concept of peace officers, who are there as a conspicuous presence for the sole purpose of protecting the rights, the individual rights, property rights, personal rights of the law-abiding. We're abandoning that in favor of something you have to call a standing army. When your typical law enforcement agency today, even in a town the size of Payette, Payette's about 8,000 people, it's really a tiny little hamlet, and our local police agency here, in spite of the fact that it's roughly the size of, I guess, we think here, I think there are maybe a dozen deputy sheriffs, maybe twice that many altogether in the police agency here, they do dispose of military-grade hardware. You go across the border, across the Snake River into Oregon, there's a little town called Ontario, which is roughly two times the size of Payette, maybe 15 or 16,000. And they do have an emergency tactical team, a SWAT team type of an outfit, which is involved with the High Desert Counter-Narcotics Task Force. And that involves, of course, kicking in doors, usually in the middle of the night or the early morning, no-knock warrant, what you would have to call it a warrantless raid, although they claim to have a search warrant, they never show it to you before they kick in your door and thrust a gun into your face. And this is something that has happened gradually, but it has accelerated just in the last 10 or 15 years. Really, the militarization of the police started in 1968. By 1969, 1970, there was talk of putting armored personnel carrier-type vehicles into the inner cities of some of the more crime-plagued jurisdictions. The SWAT teams were first devised by Daryl Gates of the LAPD back in 1968 or 1969. By 1973 or 74, they became pretty much institutionalized. By 20 years later, they become full-fledged military affiliates of the police departments. They're being trained by the Navy SEALs, by the Green Berets. They had the type of hardware in terms of automatic weapons, top-flight automatic weapons, and other hardware that they were getting through the law enforcement support organization at the Pentagon. That came online about 1995. You can get just about anything that the Pentagon has if you're a procurement agent for a sheriff's department or a police department. You can call up LESO. They actually have an online video to tell you how to go about getting this material. Everything from uniforms to boots to night vision goggles to automatic weapons to armored personnel carriers, boats, helicopters if necessary. And usually you get the taxpayers in other jurisdictions to pay for this. Now, this is purely epidemic. We don't really need this much hardware to deal with most of the circumstances that confront your typical police agency.
But don't you think a lot of this is to intimidate the people?
Yes.
That's exactly why, of course, you know, it doesn't matter. You're nonviolent. Maybe you're a minister. They're still going to handcuff you. But to humiliate you, to dehumanize you, and these are techniques that you use in a police state, not in a free society.
Well, it used to be, and this is something that not many people appreciate, and I really didn't have a chance to flesh this out in this edition of the book. If we go back to press for a second edition, I'll probably flesh this out somewhere, most likely in the chapter entitled Their Privilege to Kill, Our Duty to Die. I believe that's chapter 8 of the book, Their Privilege to Kill, Our Duty to Die. But 100 years ago, more or less, it was recognized that if a policeman did not have a valid warrant...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is talking about this whole idea of the militarization of our police, the SWAT teams, and of course they do not come in, knock on your door and present a warrant. They knock down your door, they come in with their helmets, many times wearing a mask to frighten you to death. They yell and they scream and they don't show you the warrant at all. And the whole idea, I mean, certainly there might be some instance if you had hardened criminals, but they'd use these techniques on anybody they want to. And it doesn't matter. They did this recently with a little lady somewhere in the East that they got the wrong address.
Yeah.
And, of course, she was frightened to death, lived in a crime-infested area. She had a gun. She sought three of the officers as they came in, and so they literally gunned her down. It was the wrong address. Oh, shucks, we went to the wrong place.
Yeah.
And they did not knock on the door. They did not have a legitimate warrant. They just killed that woman, and they got us scot-free.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just a mistake, ladies and gentlemen. Just a mistake. Well, William was saying, go ahead and pick up your thought there.
Well, 100 years ago or less, it was understood that if a policeman did not have a valid warrant for your arrest, or he did not have what any reasonable person would call probable cause, you actually had a recognizable, enforceable common law right to resist arrest. And that's something I certainly wish we could rehabilitate in this country. You could actually be arrested for resisting arrest. I have a whole file of cases of people who were in a situation where a police officer, for whatever reason, usually it's simply a case of somebody in a state-issued costume with a state-issued piece of costume, jewelry, and a gun, seeking to satisfy the perverted impulses of his libido dominandi, his lust for dominance, contrived a situation where he will arrest a person and then afterwards just book that person for resisting arrest. In the late 19th, early 20th centuries, it was understood that a policeman couldn't do that. A policeman could not put hands on you and force you to come with him unless he had probable cause and or a valid warrant to do so. Today, the mere act of pulling your arm away from a police officer when he puts hands on you is considered felony assault on a law enforcement officer. Once again, I have a rather large file of cases of that description where people in the course of, domestic disputes, some kind of a controversy on the streets, he gets crosswise with somebody, a police officer intervenes, all kinds of situations where a police officer puts his hands on an innocent civilian, a citizen, somebody who's invested by his creator with rights the Constitution is supposed to protect and the police officer is supposed to respect, violates the individual sovereignty of that person, puts his hands on that individual, the individual pulls away, and the police officer says, that's battery. You know, I'm going to arrest you now because you've committed battery by pulling away. The case that happened at Florida State University earlier this week where that young man got up and asked a rather long and complicated question and ended up being grabbed by security goons and then tased in the presence of an entire auditorium full of witnesses. That's a really good example of what I'm talking about here. He had done nothing to justify the bum's rush he was being given by those two tattooed, obese, most likely homosexual female cops who started to drag him away. He pulled away from them, and as a result, he ends up in a situation where there's a scrum of five or six of these people armed with tasers telling him to stop resisting, and he's saying, look, if you let me go, I will leave. At that point, they should have let him go and leave. I mean, that's all they wanted, supposedly, was that he would stop, as they perceived it, dominating the microphone and let other people have a chance to speak, and they wanted to get him out, so he was going to leave. But no, they had to make a point. The point they had to make is that they will force you to submit. Now, that is the credo. That is the practice. That is the assumption of a militarized police state. You have to submit to whoever's wearing a uniform. There was an episode in Washington involving a left-wing minister who was trying to get into a congressional hearing, and he had been waiting patiently in line. And for whatever reason, the people presiding over this dog and pony show, this charade, facade, simulacrum, fraud of a hearing involving David Petraeus, didn't want to let him in. And so he was arrested. They threw him to the floor, five or six of these police officers again, breaking his ankle in the process. And he couldn't figure out what was wrong. He ended up being charged for assault because, once again, he had tried to pull away when the police officer illegally put hands on this law-abiding citizen. There's another episode I wrote about in my blog that just took place last Friday in Roseland, Indiana, at a city council meeting, where a city councilman was evicted by the council president, and as he was leaving, this large, flaccid physique, overweight police officer shoved him from behind, planted him face first in the plate glass window, and then threw him face first in the driveway and beat on him while yelling, stop resisting, stop resisting. Now, these are the sort of things that happen daily in what we become. We're no longer a free republic. We no longer have local police. Officer friendly no longer exists.
Well, I think that we should be concerned about what's going on today, and people should understand the police should be our servants, not our masters.
Exactly.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is William Craig, and certainly I know there are some good police officers out there. I'm sure there are many of them, but it is the thing that when you have a rogue police officer who's, you know, these are the ones our attention is directed at, but so often excuses are made for them. Now, I believe the police have to be able to enforce the law, and I think that they have a difficult job. But they have to realize, of course, that when they become police officers, there's a risk to it, and they should ask questions and not shoot first. And this is increasing what they're doing, especially where there's SWAT teams, and of course, the whole idea, why should any police officer wear a mask? I thought it was only for, you know, the Lone Ranger or somebody who wanted to conceal their true identity. I mean, there should be a law against any police officer or any representative of our government wearing a mask so no one will know who they are, because as long as they are covering their identity, then you know what they're doing is illegal and immoral and wrong.
Well, you're talking about a really important cultural change here, and when I talk about officer friendly no longer existing, I'm talking about the stereotypical image that is sort of a composite of what we look for in a police officer who is a peace officer. Growing up, I spent a lot of time in the company of the police, not because I was a miscreant, but because I wanted to become a police detective. A lot of people my age, I'm 44, and a little older, can remember a time when your typical police officer was somebody who was, if not laid back, at least composed, somebody who sought to minimize his involvement in the daily life of people, and to the extent that he had interactions with people, he was always polite. He was always seeking to find some way of diffusing a situation rather than escalating it. That's a very important culture change. I talk about that in my book, too, how the default option now is overkill. The default approach is to escalate situations rather than de-escalating them. You take a look at somebody like Buford Pusser being a good example, the legendary sheriff in Tennessee. He did everything he could in very bad circumstances to de-escalate confrontations so as to avoid violence, which is one reason he carried his proverbial big stick with him rather than the gun. Toward the end of his life, he did carry a gun because he was receiving death threats, and of course half of his face had blown off and had lost his wife in that same ambush where he lost half of his face. But he did what he could to de-escalate. Today, the assumption is that the first duty of the citizen is to submit. As a matter of fact, there are many cases, and I once again am building a file of this, on this subject.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about how the attitude seems, at least in part, to have changed the attitude towards of the police towards the citizen. And certainly, as you watch television, you watch these law and order programs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, here's this rough, tough the detective, and he gets some guy into the room there, and he's grabbing him by the scruff of the neck, and he's pushing him and banging his head against the wall and choking him, you know, and he gets... where do you get off doing this sort of thing? In America, I mean, this is the sort of thing you do in a police state. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you always justify, well, this he's just trying to get the facts out. He has to find out where the bad guy has hidden the body or the kidnapped girl. Or,
mm-hmm.
And, of course, you identify with this nice detective who's just pushed to the limits, and so he's just got to resort to violence. And we begin to explain it. We begin to justify it. It's all right because it's done in the name of maintaining law and order. Watch those law and order programs. Understand how they are being used to influence our attitude towards the police and justify all sorts of excesses of violence against the populace.
Well, when you're talking about the typical law enforcement officer, the typical police officer of a generation ago, he was somebody who, to the extent that it was possible, represented the better and more disciplined element of the population. There's always going to be a situation where the hellion in high school becomes the martinet in the police officer's uniform. But by and large, a generation or so ago, or maybe even less than that, police selected heavily for people who were reasonably upright and moral and could exercise individual discipline. And standards have declined. They've been engineered downward, not only physical standards, but also moral standards. That's something my friend Kevin Beerley, who was a longtime member of the LAPD, has talked about, and he's lamented on many occasions. You know, Kevin was somebody who joined the police because of his patriotism, because of his idealism, because he despises bullies, and he wanted to do something about protecting the law-abiding. That's why he joined the police, and that's pretty typical of the motivations of people who did in the late 60s, early 70s, and maybe even a little after that. Then you started getting into the ideological aspect of trying to re-engineer the police to make it more representative of what society's supervisors believed America should look like. So suddenly you had to have female police on the streets where they don't belong, where they are not equipped by way of physical attributes or disposition to be police officers. You suddenly had the Gramscian moral revolution take place, where instead of having people who were reasonably moral, at least were governed by the biblical moral code, you had to have people who were radical feminists. They started to recruit homosexuals into the police in the 1980s, overtly. And you started seeing quotas being imposed in terms of the ethnic makeup of the police, which also compromises the quality of recruits, because once you're talking about numbers, you have to let something slide. What usually slides would be performance metrics and things of that nature. And so you end up with a different cohort of people going into law enforcement. They tend to be people who are not quite as sharp, not quite as astute, not quite as disciplined, and perhaps they compensate for that by pressing what they consider to be their authority. And at the same time, you have the militarization of police going on, a culture of impunity springing up, where you see people believing the things that they see on television about the police and granting them more leeway, as you point out, in terms of the tactics they're able to use. And by now we've reached a point where you literally can be arrested for refusing to obey the orders of an officer. Now think about that for a second, about what that implies concerning the power relationships that exist in our society. In what context is it appropriate to prosecute somebody for refusing the orders of an officer? In the military. In the military, you are required to obey the orders of an officer. In the case of martial law, presumably, you as a citizen, as a civilian, would be required to obey the orders of an officer. But in what purports to be a republic, in a time of so-called peace, where martial law has not been formally declared, how is it proper for a citizen to be arrested for refusing to obey the orders of an officer if that citizen has done nothing else that would be construed as a crime or the violation of some kind of an ordinance? Implicitly, what that tells us is that we are in a situation akin to martial law, in which citizens are supposed to defer slavishly to the orders of whoever happens to be wearing a state-issued costume and is in their vicinity. Now, that's something, once again, that most people don't think about, because while the gradient is getting steeper and our decline is accelerating, it had been rather incremental until very recently. And September 11th, of course, gave great impetus to this descent into outright, undisguised, unalloyed police state tyranny. But I think just in the last year, things have really picked up with the passage of the Military Commissions Act, which basically undermines our justice system and abolishes habeas corpus. That's the part of this whole situation that I wish to impress upon the minds of readers and listeners, is that not only are we seeing the complete evisceration of the Bill of Rights, but we're seeing the repeal of the entire Anglo-Saxon common law tradition of liberty under law, going back to the Magna Carta. I mean, the Magna Carta talks about the great writ of habeas corpus, meaning that the government has to justify detaining you. You can't simply be thrown in a dungeon somewhere at the whim of a ruler. There has to be a proceeding where you're brought before a judge, you know, present the body — that's what habeas corpus means, present the body, the living body in this case — and the government has to justify locking you up. That's something which was done away with last year, and just in the last day and a half or so, the Senate, incredible as it seems, refused to reconsider this, refused to consider a measure that would restore habeas corpus, which is the fundamental civil liberties guarantee.
But of course, they will justify this as we've got to protect ourselves from those terrible terrorists who want to take away our freedom. That's why we've got to give up our freedom.
Sure.
So the government can protect us from the terrorists. And the reason Osama bin Laden attacked us is because we were free.
Yeah. He wanted Osama bin Laden attacked us because we hadn't abolished habeas corpus, I guess.
And of course, you know, of course, don't forget the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act, which
yes.
now, of course, allows them to use the military, the American military, against American citizens. We did away with that in 1869 or 1870, somewhere in there, because of the fear of the military, which is not trained for police work. They're trained to kill. The purpose of a military is to kill. And now, why, at any time the president wants to turn them loose on the American public, he can. And in fact, he can declare a dictatorship anytime he wants to under those presidential decision directives passed on the 9th of May, as I remember, of this year.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the John Warner Defense Act is that it represents, as you say, a selective repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. That's something else I discuss in my book with respect to the fundamental change that represents. The Posse Comitatus Act was passed after the period of post-war Reconstruction in the South, post-Civil War Reconstruction, that really had led to some incredible abuses and incredible corruption, and it was done as part of a backdoor dirty deal with respect to the contested election, and I believe it was 1878. Let me make sure I get that right. 1864, 68, 70, 1876 election, actually. And the thing that I find most important about the Posse Comitatus Act is that it's intended to prevent all these things we're talking about in terms of the commingling of law enforcement and police, because those represent two completely different functions. I mean, the purpose of the military, the purpose for which we maintain a navy and for which Congress can appropriate money for and regulate an army. The army is not supposed to be a permanent function, by the way, of the government. The Navy is, but the Army isn't, according to the Constitution. But the reason why we have this, of course, is to destroy the capacity of a foreign enemy to inflict harm upon our country. That's a completely different function for the police. You know, the police, when they're involved in enforcing the law, by and large, are either deterring crime by maintaining a presence, being ready to assist citizens in repelling criminal attacks upon their persons and property, or by arresting people and delivering them to the judicial system so that they can be tried by a jury of their peers. That's a very limited function that the police is supposed to carry out. But once again, we've seen how these two roles, very disparate roles, law enforcement and the police, have been commingled, and now the commingling became complete with the passage of the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act amendment having to do with Posse Comitatus. The remarkable thing here, and this is something I talk about at length in the book as well, is the fact that all 50 state governors opposed that measure because it would permit the President of the United States to use the National Guard units of all 50 states as his own Praetorian Guard, as his own private army, in the event of, for instance, natural disaster, terrorist attack, or what the measure ominously calls combinations. A combination conceivably could be people who are organized for the purpose of opposing the war in Iraq, people who are organized for the purpose of opposing the war on our civil liberties, people who act in an organized fashion to try to reverse the damage done to our Bill of Rights. Any of these groups can be described as a combination. And invoking that measure, this president or his successor, assuming, of course, that we ever succeed in having Mr. Bush leave, would be permitted to use the National Guard to deal with the supposed threat posed by such combinations. That's a really ominous passage in what is overall a pretty horrible bill.
Well, I agree with you. I'm just so concerned about that, and that and the fact that, Cindy, as we know, any of our listeners who want to check this out, they can go up on the Internet, but they've actually, of course, giving $385 million a year to a subsidiary of Halliburton, to actually, so they to stand by to be prepared to build concentration camps in America. Now, why would you give a company not for building the concentration camps, but for being standing by to build the concentration camps with a renewal contract over a period of 4 years, $385 million a year? You're talking about over a period of 4 years, about $1.4 billion. Just to stand by to be able to build the concentration camps. And if you would like to know, we'd be glad to send you a copy of the article on this, or you can look it up on the internet. Simply Google in Halliburton, $385 million, concentration camps. And where is the outcry? I mean, why do they want to build concentration camps in America? And do they plan to put the illegal immigrants into them?
That's the pretext. Again, in the book, I talk about the interesting background here to Halliburton's role in building the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Originally, that was supposed to house illegal immigrants, too. The assumption was that political turmoil in Haiti was going to create an influx of Haitians to the southeastern United States, particularly to Florida, and we needed some place to put them. So why not put them there on the part of Cuba that is occupied by the United States? Military base at Guantanamo Bay. And so Halliburton built that facility, Camp X-Ray, which has since been enlarged and is going to be enlarged again. It's being used as a detention center for people who are designated enemy combatants. There's a talk radio host by the name of Ed Schultz, who's sort of attached to the Democratic Party. A year or two ago, he was more independent than he is now. I'm really lamenting the fact that he's become so overtly connected to the Democratic Party, because he is a very good talk show host. Unlike many talk show hosts, he actually lets callers and guests talk. He doesn't interrupt them. He doesn't suffer from Bill O'Reilly-style narcissistic logorrhea. But in any case, Ed Schultz yesterday was talking about the failure of the Senate to vote on a measure intended to restore habeas corpus. And he made a very good point. He said, what is the purpose of refusing to reinstate habeas corpus? Isn't the assumption here that there is going to be a large population of enemy combatants who would have to be denied habeas corpus protections in order to detain them at great length? What is the likeliest population from which these enemy combatants would be drawn? He said, obviously, it's the population of the United States. It's the common citizenry would be considered enemy combatants by whoever happens to be running the federal government at the time. That's a very good insight. You couple that with the fact that once again, Halliburton has this standing contract. It's on retainer to build these detention facilities. You end up with some rather unsettling assumptions that make perfect sense. Obviously, the government wouldn't be building empty concentration camps or being prepared to build empty concentration camps unless it intended to fill them. It wouldn't be insisting on the suspension of habeas corpus unless people who otherwise would be protected by habeas corpus are being looked upon as a potential population to fill those detention centers. And behind all this, of course, is the quiet but insistent refrain that this so-called war on terrorism we're involved in is a generational commitment. It is a long war, that's a title, that has been entered, that has been sort of woven into the common conversation, that it will define our lives for the foreseeable future. And James Madison, whose wisdom we desperately need today, once said that no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of perpetual warfare. That's particularly so when you talk about an open-ended war against an unidentified enemy that supposedly includes people living within the boundaries of the country in question, and there's no way to know when that war will end. There's no definitive way that the war would end with the recognizable surrender of an enemy. Nobody has an idea of what victory would look like, and when you don't know what victory would look like, obviously you're never going to win. And the objective is not to win. The objective, the purpose of this enterprise is to have a constant state of emergency that can be used to justify this type of accretion of power in the hands of the central government. And that's a terrible situation to be in. And I think just this last week, with that horrible spectacle at Florida State University, who would have thought that it would be a 21-year-old college student who seems to be reasonably well-informed, albeit somewhat undisciplined, by asking a question about John Kerry's membership in Skull and Bones would provoke an incident that would lay bare to the inspection of most of the television-watching public, what exactly is going on in this country? The summary, arbitrary, whimsical, capricious, unjust, illegal use of potentially lethal force against somebody who had done nothing by way of committing crimes against persons or property or even offenses against good order. You know, that's the sort of thing I think that has really sent a shock through people, if you forgive what can be considered a terrible pun. It really has focused the public mind on what this country is becoming in a way that I wouldn't have expected. I mean, for years, you and I, like-minded people, have been lamenting a lot of the developments we're talking about. Since the suspension, or the destruction, rather, of habeas corpus a year ago, I've been sick at my stomach. But who would have thought it would have been an instant like this that at last would at least provoke some concern on the part of millions of American television viewers? So that was an ironically healthy development. I don't know what long-term impact it might have, but at least it's nice to know people are paying attention to some of this at last.
Well, our job, of course, is to bring this before the American people and ask them why are they considering building concentration camps. We're hearing these reports from all across the country that these vacant military bases are suddenly being readied for people to come in. If you'd like to see some of the footage we have of Congressman Gonzalez speaking and saying, yes, there really is a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and round up American citizens.
You know, during the War for Independence, there was a British statesman by the name of Edmund Burke who took the part of the American colonists in lamenting, first of all, the fact that their legitimate grievances against the Crown and against Parliament were not being taken seriously. And secondly, Burke was concerned about the fact that the powers being used against the colonists imperiled the rights of Englishmen everywhere. He was particularly alarmed over the suspension of habeas corpus by King George III. That happened actually over 2 years into the war that habeas corpus was suspended, so that British subjects, they were still considered British subjects, although they had declared themselves citizens of free and independent states, the American colonists were still considered British subjects by the king. And in order to be held indefinitely as unlawful enemy combatants, the British government had to suspend habeas corpus. And in a letter to the sheriffs of Bristol, Edmund Burke famously remarked that if you can do that in that part of the British Empire, then the liberties and rights of all Englishmen everywhere in the empire were threatened. And Burke, of course, had come in from some pretty heavy criticism as a sympathizer with the Americans, and he admitted it. He said, yes, I'm sympathetic to their claims, because they're claiming only that their ancient rights as Englishmen have been abused, and that's manifestly true. But the thing that I find interesting about Burke's lament once again here is the fundamental principle that you cannot be an empire abroad and be a republic at home. Once a government becomes habituated in the use of imperial power, it will start using those powers against those who are supposedly being protected by the foreign expression of that aspect of government power. And so when we're talking about detention centers, for instance, like the one in Guantanamo, we're talking about detention centers being set up, and we talked again about the possible use of existing facilities here as detention centers. It really, I think, behooves us to take a look at how those facilities are being used abroad, which is why the Abu Ghraib scandal was such a revelation to many people. Ironically enough, I think that Abu Ghraib, the horrible, lurid, disgusting, depraved things that were done, that's actually much more typical of what goes on in our domestic prison system than most people would be comfortable admitting. Our domestic prison system, which is the largest in the world, by the way, in both per capita and absolute terms, we have more people behind bars in the United States than are behind bars in China, which is a communist country. There's just simply no way to explain that apart from the fact that there are people in those prisons who are A, political prisoners, or B, there for offenses that...
Oh, that's all right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're run out of time. Oh, anyway, I want you to go ahead and get out your blog site so people will know how to get your material. And as soon as that book's available, why, we'll help you get it distributed.
Okay. The easiest way to read what I have to say is to go to the Right Source Online, which is a news site, commentary site, for which I serve as the editor at large. It's a project of the Welch Foundation. To look at the Right Source Online, go to www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. Not the Right Source, just rightsourceonline.com.
All right, that's an excellent website, and I go to it regularly. In fact, I put it, have it labeled now among my favorites. We're out of time, but God bless you.
God bless.
We'll really look forward. I think you're going to be with us again tomorrow afternoon.
Yes, I will.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I really want to suggest that many of you will want to get the four-tape set we put together. It's called the Impending Police Tape. It goes into the background of the Joint Order Defense Appropriations Act and the Military Commission Act and certainly the Patriot Act and the Office of Homeland Security Act and the Halliburton concentration camps and the Japanese concentration camps. That is simply a four-tape set entitled The Impending Police Tape. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the four-tape set we have on concentration camps, either four-tape set or CD set. And we have most of our sets available in either tape or CDs. And then, of course, we have what we call the concentration camp special, where you'll actually see a lot of footage, some of the concentration camps. You'll actually see the Iran-Contra hearings where Congressman Jack Brooks is trying to bring out the fact that there is a plan to suspend the Constitution and put people into concentration camps. And you'll hear, of course, Senator Inouye repeatedly interrupt him, because the last thing, and this is, remember, this is back in 87 or 88, the last thing they want is for the American people to learn the truth. And then you'll hear Congressman Henry Gonzalez, you'll actually see him saying there really is a plan, in the case of a national emergency, to suspend the Constitution and put people into concentration camps. This is not imaginary. This is not hysteria. Do you care about freedom? And of course, why is this going on? Well, because there are secret societies, ladies and gentlemen. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it, or see the DVD. You need to see my talk. It's on DVD on the Forbidden Secret and the syllabus that goes with that. You need to get the DVDs, the award-winning, very professional DVDs, of The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning and Riddles in Stone. And then, of course, another DVD that we have produced called The Atlantis Connection that goes into the background that the secret societies have always felt that the United States would be the new Atlantis, the reconstitution of lost Atlantis, and would lead the whole world into the new world order, the new world religion, and, of course, the new world leader. And that's really why we're fighting over in Iraq today. We're not fighting there for any of the reasons you've been told. We are fighting there as part of a long-range plan, and the next step is to plunge us into a war with the Islamic world. And out of that will come the destruction of America as we know it, the bankruptcy of our nation, and, of course, there will be tremendous violence and chaos here, and that's what the concentration camps are all about. This is all long-range planning, because there are people out there who have a different allegiance because they worship a different God. And that's why you need to get our material. Certainly the Forbidden Secret explains that. It's all about, it's a DVD with the syllabus. Our four-tape or CD set, The Secret, Behind the Secret. The information is there. You can get, of course, many of the books if you'd like to. Some of them are not even on our regular catalog. They are in our special catalog. But, of course, what they really do, of course, is take you into the plans. They're written by people who are on the other side. And if I could suggest one, The Secret Destiny of America. It's written by Manly P. Hall, one of the most evil men who ever lived. But he will tell you, there's a long-range plan. It's been around for 3,000 years to bring the democracy to the world. Why did we go to war with Iraq? Why, we wanted to bring democracy. Pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Put that lies plural. That's right. They see the big